There's going to be an inquiry into why Britain went to war in Iraq. It'll be full, it'll be frank, it'll be in secret. They're going down like flies, the British MPs caught up in the great expenses fiddle. Now prosecutions may follow. He's not just the commander-in-chief, he's the fly-swatter supreme. Barack Obama added to his long list of accomplishments by killing a pesky fly live on TV, and that's not easy. Clearly the president enforces his own no-fly zone. I promise you, this is the real deal.
Ow! Just the way you move, it's a real deal. And the way you groove, oh, it's the way I feel, yeah, yeah. You're a wild thing and you're a natural star. Got me crazy about the way you are. So I'm a deal, baby, you're the real deal.
Hello and welcome to The Real Deal with me, George Galloway, on Press TV. Each week from London at this time, I'm bringing you the news and views you just won't find in the corporate media. As always, I'll be shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip. But you could fire back at me, at least by email, at realdeal@presstv.co.uk. The story of the week, as far as the Western media are concerned, was the Iranian elections and the resulting street protests. If you ever believed that the BBC, that's the Bush and Blair Corporation, and the US media, like Rupert Murdoch's Fox Network, were impartial, then here was the mountain of evidence against. Opinion masquerading as fact, at length, and usually on shaky cam. For the record, here's my declaration of interest. Press TV is Iranian-owned, but that doesn't influence my opinion, which is that until there's even a scintilla of evidence that the election was fiddled, we have to accept the verdict of the Iranian people, however much some of us may not like it. But there's a track record of Britain and the US not accepting democratic decisions, as the starving people of Gaza, who put their crosses in the wrong place, can testify. Shortly, I'll be giving you an update on the Viva Palestina US convoy to the Gaza Strip, which leaves from New York on July 4th, Independence Day. Irony intended. And it seems there may even be a chink of light in opening up the blockade. Michael Martin, the Speaker of the House of Commons, he's a kind of parliamentary referee, watching out for low verbal blows and misdemeanors, left the post during the week, the first Speaker to be forced from office in 300 years. That's him with his hands up. It was over the expenses scandal, which has claimed more MPs and ministers than I have fingers and toes. Martin had another flaw, one he couldn't disguise. He was working class, a former shop floor worker and trade unionist with a Glasgow accent. Not at all a chap with the cut of jib the Parliament was used to. I've known him for decades. When he was first elected to Parliament, he used to send his washing home to his wife every week in parliamentary envelopes. I don't know if they know that. But it was dirty washing, or his failure to deal with it, which did for him. For most of the last month, the Daily Telegraph newspaper has been revealing which MPs and government ministers bent or even broke the parliamentary allowances system, claiming everything from widescreen TVs to moat cleaning. I've lost count of the number forced to resign or not seeking re-election, and now the police may deal with some of the more blatant frauds on the public. I supported the call for a general election over it, but the motion was lost. What I know for sure is that these recidivists will pay the penalty whenever that election is called. Gordon Brown, in one of the deals he was forced to agree to stay in power, announced midweek that there would be an inquiry into why Britain joined the US in the devastating invasion of Iraq. It will be in secret. Well, perhaps the less controversial witnesses will be allowed to be heard, but given all of the evidence in the public domain already, the dozens of books and millions of words, and given the composition of establishment flunkies on the panel, I really wonder what there is new to come out and what the outcome will be, apart from yet another traditional British whitewash. We know everything we need to know about the duplicity, the mendacity and the criminality involved. But what we can be sure of in the measured conclusion to the report of the inquiry is that there will not be a recommendation that Tony Blair and the other cabinet ministers who went along with him will face prosecution for war crimes. Now that's the only just result. What do we need in the public right now? Well, an urgent parliamentary debate into the current war in Afghanistan would be good, but instead there's only silence, as there was over Iraq. Not since Caligula appointed his horse as a proconsul of Rome Has there been a more inappropriate appointment than Tony Blair as Middle East peace envoy? His hands are dripping with the blood of the Middle East. Here's how the Labour-supporting Daily Mirror newspaper saw him. But now there's further sticky involvement. According to the Guardian newspaper, Blair was aware of the existence of the secret interrogation policy, which effectively led to British citizens and others being tortured by counterintelligence agents. Blair effectively condoned it. Victims of torture, victims of extraordinary rendition in the official sophistry, alleged that British agents were present at their torture. British intelligence officers were apparently instructed that if they witnessed torture, they were not under any obligation to prevent it. And if that isn't colluding in torture, then what is? US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman a couple of days back. I know it's gruesome. It said there are two things you need to know about Hillary, that she's smarter than you are and that she's way nastier. I don't know how bright Lieberman is, but he more than matches Hillary on the second part. The meeting was a precursor to the one this week between the US Middle East peace envoy George Mitchell and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I have great hopes for Mitchell. He was, after all, the man who forged a peace in Northern Ireland after more than 300 years of conflict. But I invest little in Hillary, and none at all in Netanyahu. Although there are signs that behind the scenes, the new US administration may be prepared to get tough with Israel over Gaza. I'll be talking to my colleague Kevin Ovenden in Chicago about this shortly, and about the Viva Palestina convoy to the Gaza Strip, which sets out on US Independence Day, the 4th of July. Hillary's boss, Barack Obama, at least I hope that's the way it is, decisively policed his own no-fly zone last week, swatting fatally the persistent fly which unwisely buzzed him in his live interview. It's not easy swatting a fly with your hand, but in a blur of motion, he did it. It's on YouTube. Contrast this with Dick Cheney's famous confrontation with a winged creature when he gave both barrels to a friend rather than the quail. I'm just back from the States, where I've been speaking and putting the final touches to the convoy to Gaza, which leaves on the 4th of July, American Independence Day. With me will be Ron Kovic, the Vietnam War hero immortalized by Tom Cruise in the movie Born on the 4th of July. On the line now from Chicago is the coordinator of the convoy. He also coordinated the British convoy. That's Kevin Ovenden. Kevin, welcome to The Real Deal.
Thank you very much, George. I'm very pleased to be on the show.
Now, it seems that the US are beginning to put some pressure on Israel over the blockade of Gaza. What do we know about that?
Well, what we know is that 3 weeks ago, there was a communication from the US State Department to Israel, putting them under pressure to allow medical supplies and other supplies through the border which they directly control, the Eretz crossing into the Gaza Strip. This is reported widely in Israel in the best-selling paper Haaretz, and the Israelis are certainly feeling under some pressure from that, and of course from the speech made a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, by the President of the United States himself, Barack Obama, in Cairo.
And Jimmy Carter's just been in Gaza, and he had some hard things to say, didn't he?
He did indeed. He described the treatment of the people in Gaza, the Palestinian population, in very robust terms. He said that people were being treated worse than animals. Now, it doesn't get much stronger than that. And Jimmy Carter is, of course, the former president of the United States from the 1970s. He's a well-respected figure over here. His comments got quite a lot of publicity in the U.S., even despite the control of the corporate media and its bias towards Israel and its policy inside the Middle East. So this is all coming after a sense of change in the United States. It's quite extraordinary. Even in the United States, in December and January, with the unforgivable and murderous assault on the people of Gaza by Israel, we found that a majority of Americans opposed that assault. And this is the first time that an Israeli policy has been greeted with majority opposition in the United States. So there's a feeling amongst the grassroots of people here. There's a feeling particularly amongst Arab and Muslim Americans who have been through their own internal Guantanamo over the last 8 years, a Guantanamo of the mind where people were under such pressure that people didn't feel that they could speak out. They couldn't put Palestinian pro-Palestinian bumper stickers on their cars. There's an awful case here, hailing from those years, of five people who were raising funds for the needy in Palestine, two of whom have been sent to prison for 65 years, one of whom is 70 and ill, sent to prison for 15 years. So you can imagine the degree of intimidation that people have felt in the United States. And now, over the past few months, there's a big feeling that that dark night is ending and more people feel that they can speak out for justice.
A wind of change then in the windy city of Chicago. Kevin, thanks for that. We'll be getting together again in the next few hours, in fact, preparing for the great American convoy, which we hope will be seen on Press TV crossing into Gaza a few days after the convoy lands in Egypt. Go to vivapalestina-us.org for details. Now, I met up with my other guest earlier. He's the academic and author, Professor David Cesarani, and we talked about his new book on some of the pernicious roots of the Middle East conflict, intriguingly called Major Farhan's Hat. It's really the little-known story of Jewish and, indeed, British terrorism. Here's what he had to say. Baby, you're the real deal, yeah. David Cesarani is a historian and author. He's research professor of history at London's Holloway University. His new book is called Major Farhan's Hat. David, welcome. It's a very catchy title and a very good cover. Tell us what it's about.
Well, it's about a counterinsurgency operation that the British mounted against the Jewish underground that was fighting British rule in Palestine at the end of the British mandate over Palestine in 1947. The Jewish population of Palestine was in a state of revolt, fighting to create a Jewish state, which they believed was theirs by the right of the League of Nations agreement made with Britain in 1920. Britain had withdrawn from that promise, and various reasons, which we can't go into now, the Jewish population had become embittered and angry, deeply scarred by the events of the Second World War, the mass murder of Jews in Europe, determined to fight for a Jewish state. And within the Jewish population, there were a number of quite ruthless underground organizations, which we would call terrorist groups. They played havoc with the British occupation forces. And in desperation, the British administration in Palestine, with the agreement of the British government in London, brought in really tough commandos, men who'd served in the special air service behind enemy lines during the Second World War, in an attempt to break the Jewish underground and to restore law and order and to restore British rule over Palestine so that the British could decide what to do with their mandate, whether to stay or whether to leave under conditions of their own choosing. But it was absolutely crucial for them at this particular moment in the spring of 1947, when the United Nations, a successor to the League of Nations, was looking at the future of Palestine. It was absolutely crucial to the British to break the Jewish underground. And two particular terrorist groups, or underground freedom fighters, if you want to call them that, the Stern Gang.
But what should we call them, David? Because that in a sense, is the nub of things. Should we call them an underground guerrilla group, or should we call them terrorists, or are they in fact both, just like their Palestinian counterparts later in this story?
Well, I think there are many similarities to the situation the Jews in Israel faced when dealing with the Palestinian national movement and Palestinian resistance. But that's, in a sense, looking the wrong way. What the British thought they were dealing with was something like the IRA. Mm. And they approached the Jewish underground in Palestine in the same way they tried to repress the IRA in Ireland in the early 1920s. They failed in Ireland, and for very similar reasons, they failed in Palestine. In Ireland, they brought in ex-army men to form a kind of auxiliary police militia.
These men were black and tans, yes.
Exactly. And many of those same black and tans ended up in the Palestine police force. They also used typical counterinsurgency methods, which alienated the population, collective punishment, mass arrests, internment. The usual counterinsurgency methods the British employed in Ireland that they translated to Palestine simply weren't succeeding. So they went for something that was new, and which many analysts of counterinsurgency warfare argue augurs a new era. What they say is that the counterinsurgency squad, operating underground, arm's length from the police and the army, led by Major Roy Farron, who gives his name to the title of the book, this counterinsurgency squad is a forerunner of the counterinsurgency wars that the British fought in Malaya and Kenya, that the Americans fought
in Vietnam.
Phoenix.
It's the Phoenix type of operation, isn't it?
It's the Phoenix type of operation. And in every case, there's been a disaster. And the disaster usually unfolds in exactly the same way. You take men who are ruthless killers, you pit them against an equally ruthless enemy, but you tell them, in effect, you have carte blanche. Use whatever methods you think are necessary to root out this terrorist group, this underground resistance, root them out, destroy them. And we're not going to ask too many questions how you go about it. Then someone gets murdered, an extrajudicial execution. There's a scandal, an expose, all hell breaks loose. And this has been a pattern that we've seen time and time again from the British struggle against the IRA in Northern Ireland all the way through to operations in Iraq in the last few years.
Indeed. Now, this is where Major Farron's hat comes in, isn't it? Because he drops his hat at the scene of a particularly notorious murder.
That's right. Major Farron's unit was cruising the suburb of Rahavia, part of Jerusalem. They came across a young man, a teenager, distributing pamphlets, leaflets for the Jewish underground group, the Stern Gang. They grabbed him, they pulled him into the car, but in a struggle, the hat got knocked off. The car drove away, and bystanders saw, at the scene of this abduction, a hat lying in the street. Now, they didn't know the significance of this at first. Some people just took it and they left it in a nearby synagogue. But Alexander Rubovitz, his family, that was the name of the boy who was abducted.
He was what, 17?
Just 17. They became very worried. He didn't come home the next day. They went to the police. The police said, oh, we know nothing about an Alexander Rubovitz. He's not being held in custody. But the family were very persistent. I should say that at this time, there was internecine warfare between the different Jewish underground groups, the Haganah, the Irgun, led by Menachem Begin, and the Stern Gang. They were at each other's throats. They routinely kidnapped people. And the British police hoped that the abduction of this kid, Alexander Rubovitz, would be dismissed as another case of inter-Jewish warfare. But the family were persistent. They put photographs of the boy in the Hebrew press with descriptions. And one of the people who'd seen the abduction recognized the face and remembered that there had been a hat lost at the scene of the abduction. Eventually, the hat was collected by the family, and they saw written inside the sweatband the name Farron. They gave the hat to the police for forensic examination. But soon, the existence of this hat leaked out. The name Farron appeared in the press, and an accusing finger pointed at Major Farron, a brave, incredibly courageous young major, 26-year-old major, seconded from the British Army to the Palestine Police Force. Farron was brought into Palestine, as I'd said, to help break the underground. And when the finger of accusation pointed at him, the undercover operation was revealed.
It was blown.
The cover was blown, and scandal ensued.
Indeed, and of course it didn't end with him. His brother was blown up in presumably, because I didn't get to that point yet, but presumably a Jewish terrorist attack on his family home, intending to kill him, killing his brother instead. Yeah. It's a fascinating story, published by Heinemann. It's out now in all good bookshops.
It's out now in all good bookshops,
and also on Amazon. I'm definitely going to read it. It's interesting as a detective story in itself, but as you have said, it's redolent of so many such counterinsurgency intentions, which perhaps start out with the good intentions but end up in murder and cover-up and more murder. And that's something that everyone can learn from. David Cesarani, Professor of History, thank you very much for joining us on The Real Deal.
My pleasure.
One man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. I think it was Edmund Burke who said that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Whereas the American satirist Edmund Bierce saw history differently. He called it an account, mostly false, of events, mostly unimportant, which are brought about by rulers, mostly knaves, and soldiers, mostly fools. Perhaps there's something to both of those views. Now, this is the spot where we look back to on this day in history. In 1945, the Japanese island of Okinawa finally fell to the Americans after a long and bloody battle. More than 90,000 Japanese troops were killed in the 82 days. Some may even be in the jungle to this day. In 1982, Princess Diana gave birth to a boy called William, or Billy. He'll become the second King Billy, after his father Charles. That is, if the present Queen ever trusts him enough to abdicate. The picture shows William practicing his royal duties. The first King William of Orange is famous, or infamous, for invading Ireland and defeating the Catholics in 1690. And you still can't be a Catholic and accede to the British throne. After more than 300 years, that's progress, huh? And finally, in 1990, an earthquake, a geographical one, struck and smashed Iran. More than 25,000 people were killed and tens of thousands more injured in an earthquake near the Caspian Sea. Hundreds of towns and villages were razed to the ground. That was on this day in history. Well, there's no time for fighting talk this week. I hope to be fighting out in front of you next week. But until then, God willing, may you go in peace. I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal on Press TV. I'll be back next week, same time, same place.
Catch up with the news that you missed during the week. Unbiased reporting from our correspondents. Highlights from our cutting-edge documentaries. The week's best in discussions. Interview highlights. Reporter packages condensed to give you the news that you missed. Give us 25 minutes. And we'll give you news unlike other mainstream media. Make Reality Check your stop for the week in news and what you missed on Press TV with me, Kaveh Taklai.
France, the land of liberty and equality, has just passed a law banning the Muslim headscarf in schools. It's done this, it says, to defend fiercely protected concepts of secularism, essentially the separation of church and state. But some say this is simply racism, attacking a weak and visible minority, and whatever the cause, the result is that hundreds of young women are now facing a terrible choice between religion or an education.
Et j'estime que nous n'avons pas à bafouer les lois françaises, sinon nous sommes indignes de la France. Nous aimons la France, nous respectons la France.
Le foulard, quoi, je voulais vraiment. Maintenant, j'ai compris que ce foulard avait plus d'importance, alors je me dis, ça fait rien si...
I'm doing a PhD, but I'm conscious that it's going to be very, very hard here in France to find a job, just because I'm wearing the headscarf.
The real question is, do I have the right as a French citizen to choose Islam or not? And this is a real question. Until now, they've answered no.